Please join me in welcoming our speaker tonight, Bob L. from Glendale, California.
Hi, my name is Bob Lemke. I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here. I want to thank Chris for the invitation, the committee for a nice dinner tonight, and all of you. It's always a pleasure for me to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's a little more meaningful when there's new people or comparatively new people, because whether you new people realize this or not, and I'm sure you don't because we didn't, fact of life. Next to us old-timers, you're the second most important people in the room tonight. Don't ever forget it. But really, without you new people, this thing would probably end up with all us old-timers sitting around here telling these same old stories. We probably all get drunk. I'm what the book says, the real alcoholic. In fact, I'm one of them bar-drinking drunks. Aren't any bar drinkers here tonight? Thank God. I mean, I don't know the rest of you did your thing, but I'll tell you this. If you didn't get some bar time in, you missed a lot of fun. I loved everything about those joints, you know? I loved everything that goes on in there. I like the smell in there. I like them stools you can spin around on. I like the mirrors that they got in those places, you know? Chris and I could go out here tomorrow on one of the main streets in downtown Portland, open up a joint without a mirror. Fact of life, we go broke in 2 weeks. Three things you have to have in this country in order to operate a bar successfully. One, you got to have the booze. Second, you got to have a license to sell it. And third, you got to have a mirror. Or you will not make it in the bar business. That mirror, incidentally, is not there for social drinkers. Bars cannot survive on social drinkers. They depend on people who drink in volume. And you and I are the volume drinkers of this world. Social drinkers do weird stuff in bars. You bar drinkers know what I'm talking about. They come in, they have a couple drinky poos, and then they start saying weird off the wall kind of crap like, "Ooh, I'm getting dizzy, I'm going home." Going home. People like you and I, we sit there all day. And we have to have something to entertain ourselves, and it's usually our own image. That's the mirror. And we sit there all day staring in the mirror, you know. Figuring things out, you know. I like those jukeboxes they have in them joints. You know, the ones that play Born to Lose all day. I even got to like the men's John in them places. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, we used to have a guy in AA by the name of Norm Alpe, who, in my opinion, is the greatest speaker Alcoholics Anonymous ever had, ever will have. And he was a bar drinking drunk, and the first time I heard him, he was up at one of these podiums, and he talked fast. I mean, he's the only man up till tonight can give a one-hour talk in 32 minutes. God rest his soul. And he's up there and he's going on and on. All of a sudden, he said something weird. He said he got to be a bathroom slider in the men's john. And right away, one of the bananas fell out of my ears. And I thought, what's this clown talking about? You know, I thought I'd done it all by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know about you, but I thought I'd done it all. And here's this guy talking about something completely foreign to me. I don't know what in the world he's talking about. And he went on to explain that bathroom sliders in the men's john, I think in the ladies too, where they have them paid toilets. Good, keen, smart alcoholics slide under the door and save that money for drinking whiskey. Right away, I thought, by God, why didn't I think of that? I bet you there's a couple newcomers thinking that right now. And then he went on to explain whenever he got done doing what he was doing in there, he'd slide back out. Never realizing, of course, that once you're in there, you can turn the handle and walk out, you know. Anybody that thinks like that is a friend of mine. And so I'm eternally grateful to Norm Alpes and the Eddie Regans and the Chuck Chamberlains and Jimmy Ryans who said things from podiums like this to drunks like me, or I would not be here. Would not be here. They made sense to me, and I can't understand today, up to today, I can't believe that I believe these people were telling the truth. Because up to the day I walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe no human beings. Because they all had to be phonies, cheats, and liars like me. That's the only kind of people I associate with. And I can't explain it, that I believe that these people had been where they'd been and done what they had done. And they all made sense to me, and they saved my soul, saved my can, and I am eternally grateful. Are there any Texans in the room tonight? There's a Texan. See, they move around a lot, you know. The reason I ask that is when you talk in Texas, and he'll verify it, if in the first 5 minutes of your talk you don't tell them your sobriety date, they automatically assume you don't have one. Yeah. And so in deference to the Texans here tonight, my sobriety date is 13th of January, 1964. Wow. That means in about 80-some days, I'll be 41 years sober. And for I am eternally grateful. I am eternally grateful. Because I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get 41 years sober. I came here to get all those people off my back. And bill collectors and that woman and those kids and that damn dog and the IRS. And if they'd all get off my back, everything would be all right. And that's the way it really was. And so I'm eternally grateful for my time here. You know, when I got sober in the 60s, a lot of things were going on in this country, you know. And some of it's still going on. But Vietnam was going on and all that stuff, you know. And there was another thing going on that a lot of people in AA don't even know about. There were a lot of discussions going on in this country, in the state houses in this country, in the political arena. Talking about one thing, and every one of them were talking about the same thing. They were all talking about alcoholism and what effect it was having on this country and the economy and the damage for corporations and equipment and trucks busted and all this stuff. And about this same time, 5 truck drivers in Iowa went on a drunk. And nobody in this little town in Iowa could find them. And at last it got to be quite a concern of the whole little community. And they sent out a bunch of guys to try and find these 5 drunk truck drivers. And finally one of the guys was going up this little alley or dirt road, and he saw this little corrugated metal shed. And he opened it up, and there they were. 3 of them were dead from chronic alcoholism, and 2 of them were still alive. And he pulled him out, and he got him sober, and one of those guys, if you believe it or not, got to be the governor of the state of Iowa. People don't get to be governor from where we come from. And he got to be the governor of the state of Iowa. And he used to sneak out of the governor's mansion at 3 in the morning, go call on some sick drunk. And the drunk didn't even know he was the governor, you know? And the people of Iowa loved him so much, they sent him to the United States Senate. And he got to be the United States Senator from the state of Iowa. He's one of us. And the first piece of legislation he and a couple other senators authored was on alcoholism treatment in this country, because it was becoming such a problem. And he assigned the assignment to the Department of Health and Human Services, and he gave them the money. They put their money where their mouth was. And that's where all these programs in this country started, in these hospitals and different kinds of programs all over the country. And then the medical profession started to get interested, because up until 1960, in the early 60s, most people in the medical profession defined alcoholism as a Valium deficiency. Gospel truth. Yeah, just feed them Valium, keep them quiet. They don't pay their bill anyhow. Just give them some Valium, keep them quiet. And so that's how this all started. And then the medical profession got into this thing, and they started meeting with people like you and I. And they've come up with 2 schools of thought, and they're still doing it today. One side of the house says it's hereditary. You get it in the genes. And the other side of the house says, no, you get it from consumption and assumption. And I don't know who's right, and I really don't care. I just know I are one, you know? But if this thing has anything to do with hereditary, I'm the kind of guy that I get sober, and I'm wondering why this all happened to me, you know? And I start looking back on my family tree, and I've gone back as far as my great-grandfather, and I find out he was an alcoholic. And my grandfather was an alcoholic. My dad and his two brothers were alcoholics. My oldest brother and I are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. My two kids are alcoholics. You'd almost think it's hereditary in my family. But then there's my middle brother. He's a social drinker. And I watch him like a hawk. And he lives in San Francisco, and I live in Glendale. And about once a year, I have a house in the desert, and we kind of meet down in the desert and have a mini family reunion. And he likes to drink Old Fitz on the rocks. So I always have a bottle of Old Fitz at the house in the desert. And like I say, I watch him. When he comes in the house, he heads right for the kitchen. He goes into that kitchen and opens up that cupboard, gets that bottle of Old Fitz off the shelf, and then he finds a big glass, which is a tip-off to me. And you know what he does? He fills it full of ice. Then he takes that bottle and he spritz it around like this, you know, big deal. And then he takes that glass of whiskey and goes in my living room, sits down on my couch, takes that glass of whiskey, puts it on my end table, picks up a book and starts to read. I tell him, for God's sake, man, drink it! You know what he does? He sits there for 3 hours, sipping and reading. At last, I have to leave the house. I can't stand that. I don't know how anybody can do it. All the people I know, most of the people I know are members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we don't sip nothing. We're gulpers. We're insidious slurpers of liquids. We don't sip nothing. Down. Put it. Water. We don't sip water. Soda pop. Norms is looking at us and say, you drank it already? Yeah, what's the big deal? I'm beginning that I don't trust sippers. But when I was drinking, this same brother, I'm sure it never happened to anybody here, but when I drink, I get into financial problems. Real financial problems. And once in a while, I'd get in these financial jackpots, and I would, out of desperation, I would call him and tell him what the situation is, and I need some money. And invariably, he would send it. And 2 weeks after he sent it, and I try to get this financial mess cleaned up in my life, he would call, and he'd ask me stupid questions that normies ask alcoholics. He'd say things like, I heard you're drinking again. Well, what's the big deal? And then I think, how the hell does he know? He lives in San Francisco. I live in Glendale. And I got that figured out now. It's my mother. She lives in Wisconsin, 2,000 miles away, and she can smell whiskey on me 2,000 miles away. And she'd call him and say, Bob's drinking again. And then he asked me those stupid questions, you know. But he has become we've become good friends over the years. We've become good friends. And it's incredible. And then I get to thinking about how this, I'm a me, 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 I. I don't know about you, but that's the way I think. Me, 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 I. And I think, how did this all happen to me? And I've come to some conclusions now, over the years, and now they're my conclusions, and I'm stuck with them. But I've come to the conclusion that I had a big problem the day I was born. I had two strikes against me right out of the chute, you know. First of all, I was born in this little town in Wisconsin, and you all know how little towns are. Everybody knows everybody's business, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes that's bad. And in my case, it seemed it was always bad. And the second strike I had against me was my dad was assistant chief of police in that damn town. He is about 6'4", weighed 240 pounds, wore a uniform, carried a gun, scared the living bejesus out of you. And for the first 15 years of my life, I did everything that that turkey told me to do, just out of fear. Because I knew deep down inside, if he ever hit me, he'd kill me. You know, he's a big moose and a tough cop, and I'm scared to death of him. I mean, little things. If he told me to run to the store, I literally ran to the store. I mean, I didn't slow down when I got out of sight or nothing, either. And I'd run all the way back. If he told me to carry out the trash, I carried out everything that even looked like trash. If he told me to rake the leaves, I even raked the neighbor's leaves. And in Wisconsin, they have a lot of snow. And he taught me very early in life, if 5 flakes of snow fell on our sidewalk, it was my job to take it off there. And I did it religiously out of fear until this magical thing that happens to all human beings happened. About the age of 15, something happens to human beings. Medical science can't explain it. You know that it happened to you, and I know that it happened to me. And I don't know how it happened to you. If you don't believe any of this, incidentally, go out here tonight, right now. Find a 15-year-old. Ask him or her a question on any subject in the world, and they'll tell you. The smartest thing walking the face of the earth right this minute is a 15-year-old. In their humble opinion. And you were no different, and I was no different. And I don't know how it happened to you, but I have this idea. I think it came floating on a cloud at night in my bedroom or something and went kaboom. And no bells or whistles went off, but I knew the next morning something was different. And I remember this like it was yesterday. I got up, got dressed, went downstairs, have breakfast. Finished my breakfast, headed off to school. No big deal. Come home from school at noon. It was snowing. I know my job, right? But this thing had happened in the night. And I said, screw it. I just won't do it no more. My logic and reasoning was, what will the neighbors say? A genius out there shoveling snow, you know? All of a sudden, it's beneath my status in life. I just won't do it. And I took that snow shovel and set it up against the house and went in and said, to hell with him. I just won't do it no more. Went in the kitchen, sat down, started eating my lunch. And then I heard the squad car pull up in front. Then I heard the car door slam. Then I heard the shovel out there on the sidewalk. I said, it's about time he does something around here. Have you ever had the feeling like you got to do it all? That's the way I felt. And he came in the house all out of breath because he wasn't used to that manual labor. I'm doing it all. Took off that uniform cap and that big heavy Mackinaw they wear in the winter and that Sam Brown belt and that 45 and laid it on the dining room table like he did every day. Came in the kitchen, sat down at the kitchen table right across from me. And then he threw me a curve. He didn't say a word. And if you've just been endowed with the smarts, that will drive you nuts. I'm just waiting for him to say something, you know. I've been saving it up for 15 years, and today is the day. And he didn't say a word again, and I finished my lunch ahead of him, and I had to go back to school. I can remember this like it happened this morning. Got up, walked around the kitchen table, had to go past him, out through the dining room, through the living room, out the front door, back to school. I can't explain this neither, and I'm sure you understand it. I just knew deep down inside, I could not let a situation like this go by without saying something. And I stopped right in front of him, looking right in the eye, reached down inside and got one of them pearls of wisdom I'd just been endowed with, right? Looked him right in the eye, said the smartest thing I could think of. I said, is the snow heavy today? Big mistake. He didn't say a word again. He just kind of turned in the chair like this and came all the way from right field with a flatted hand, direct hit. And I took off in the air up against the dining room windows. When I came to, I developed another bad attitude. I said to myself, and only to myself, nobody can hit me like that and get away with it. I'll get even with him, by God, if it kills me. But I'll tell you something else. 10 seconds before he hit me, He was the sun, moon, and stars of my life, the big hero of my life. And that's what I'm going to be when I get big and all that crap. And all he had to do was hit me, and that fast. I hate his guts. Hate his guts. And in the quiet of my room at night, I used to plan his demise. I understand today that's not proper thinking for a 15-year-old to be planning his father's demise. But that's the way it really was. And some of these things I'm about to tell you after this hitting incident, and that incidentally was the one and only time he ever hit me in my life. Some of these things that I'm about to tell you, I believe, have had, including the hitting incident, have all had an effect on my attitude towards people, places, and things. And by the time I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, my attitude towards people, places, and things was a little messed up, I would say. About a year after that hitting incident, another big deal happened. Another cold winter day in Wisconsin, the snow piled up as high as this beam here. And three of my buddies and I come home from school about 4 p.m, walk down the street, get to the corner to go down to my house. And there, passed out in a snowbank in full uniform, is my dad, dead drunk. And these three supposed buddies started teasing me about my drunk dad, the drunk cop. And we went to Fist City right there, and I won. But I'll never forget the feelings and emotions I had that day. I realized then and there, first of all, that he had disgraced that uniform he wore, disgraced that badge he wore, and lost the faith and trust of that community that he had pledged his life to protect and to serve. Big deal. About a year after that incident, another big deal happened. At the age of 47, he died of chronic alcoholism. Didn't say that on his death certificate, incidentally. He's a big shot in that town. It said heart disease. But those of us who lived with him knew that booze had gotten him. And I found out another fact of life, that doctors, yeah, doctors, lie on death certificates for certain people in certain towns, and they're still doing it today. Fact of life. About a year after that incident, another big deal happened. I was going with this gal. When I say we were going together, we started out in kindergarten together. Same kindergarten, same grade school, same high school, same Sunday school, same church. Right out of high school, we got married. It was a beautiful event. Crossed white shotguns, everything. She never did like me to say that, you know. I used to slough it off by saying it happens in the best regulated families, right? And that was the 12th of January, 1948. And had she known on the 12th of January, 1948, that she was going to go through 16 years of living hell, I know what she'd have told me. Because she comes from one of them normsy families, whatever that is. I mean, they did weird stuff, I thought. They go to church on Sundays and picnics in the park and walks in the woods. And I don't know anything about that stuff. And like all women, she started to demand things right after we got married. Like furniture to sit on and curtains on the windows and all that kind of stuff. And I don't have any money. And so I go down and see my dad's buddy, the chief of police, told the chief, she wants all this stuff, and I don't have any money. He said, go up to the sheriff's department tomorrow. I think they need help. Any of you who come from a small town, you know the process. One phone call is all it took. Walked into the sheriff's department the next morning, they pinned a gold badge on me. And I got to be a drunk cop, just like my dad. And time doesn't permit me to tell you what can happen to a drunk cop, except stir up some old resentments, and God knows you probably don't need any more, especially when it comes to cops. Bunch of cop haters right over there. Some right over there. I can spot them a mile away. But I'll tell you right now, if I could be anything in this world this very minute, it'd still be a cop. I loved every minute of it. I loved all the excitement, the camaraderie, and everything that goes with being a cop. And I don't know what was going on in your life prior to your entering Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll tell you another fact of life. Do you know that 99 out of 100 human beings, that isn't only us, that's all those people out there, 99 out of 100 human beings have one thing in their life that's the single most important thing in their life. And in 99 out of 100 cases, that one single thing is another human being. Isn't it incredible? It's a wife, a husband, a lover, a child, a parent, a grandparent, aunts, uncles, somebody. This is the single most important thing in 99 out of 100 people's lives, except cops. And they all have one thing that's above all human things. It's a damn badge. And everybody that's ever carried one will tell you the same thing I'm about to tell you. I'd have done anything short of murder to keep that damn badge, except stay away from one drink of whiskey. And this woman been putting up with my crap for a long time. She got to be black belt Al-Anon. I mean, she was tough before Al-Anon, you know. I mean, she started to really get tough with me, you know. And she said bad things to me. I was telling this young gal over here, right there. Right after we got married, I'm down at a bar on a Saturday afternoon watching football, just like today, you know, watching football with boys, you know, got a little drunk. Come home, she's madder than a wet hen, you know. She had that honeydew list already, you know. And I'm not there to do it. And I come stumbling in the house and weaving back and forth, and she happened to be ironing. And she happened to be ironing her bra. And I stand there weaving back and forth. I says, "What do you want to iron that for? You ain't got nothing to put in it." She said, to iron it down like this, looked me right in the eye and says, "I iron your shorts, don't I?" And that was before Al-Anon, you know. She didn't take no crap off of me, boy. But the worst side of that whole thing is, on the 23rd of November 2001, she was contracted with cancer. And on the 23rd of December 2001, 30 days later, she was gone. 3 weeks short of 54 years of marriage. And my life has changed. My life has changed. And I miss her. And I hate them damn dishes. And that laundry. I think I'm the only man on the face of the earth can put three creases in front of a man's pants. Yeah? Just drives me nuts. I think, how the hell did he do that? And so I'm eternally grateful that I've had 54 years of her. I guess it's important I tell you about my last drunk, because I've been here long enough to say this with authority. If you can't remember your last drunk, you probably haven't had it yet. And I don't know about any of you, but I never want to forget what was going on in my life the day I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous in utter desperation. And if you're new or comparatively new here tonight, I hope you're as desperate about this deal as you've been about anything in your life. Because I believe the more desperate you are about this, the better shot you've got at making it. My last drunk was no big deal. I didn't sit around and plan it for 3 weeks or something. You know, it just happened. It was a Friday night, the 27th of December, 1963. Just finished eating dinner. Made the big announcement to that woman and those kids. Told them I'm going out and have a couple beers with the guys. I'll be back in 2 hours. And she started that rhetoric, you know, that yak, 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 yak. And we get fed up with that crap too, you know. And I said, "Listen, woman, I want to tell you something for the last time. I just put in 40 for a bunch of ingrates around here. And I'm going out and commiserate with my friends, and I'll be back in 2 hours, and I'll knock it off." And that was, like I say, it was the 27th of December, 1963, at about 7 in the evening. And I got back on the 13th of January, 1964. Can't tell you to this day where the hell I was. I know on the 27th of December, 1963, at about 7:30, I went to my favorite watering hole, a place called the Prelude. Now, isn't that a nice name for a dump? The Prelude, it has the connotation you're only going to be there for a little bit, you know. The Prelude on Lancashire Boulevard in North Hollywood, which really isn't a heck of a lot to shoot for. It was one of those padded sewers I'd start to frequent. You know the kind I'm talking about? They don't even have a front door. Just curtains hanging there. You've been in one, huh? And I really went there to meet these lifelong drinking buddies of mine who I just met 2 weeks ago, right? And sure enough, they were all there. And we started doing the things that real drunks do in bars. They're doing it right now in Portland, Oregon. And they're doing it in New York City. The same identical thing. Not one thing has changed. You bar drinkers know what I'm talking about. They're standing around there talking in millions and spending in dimes. Trying to impress people we don't know with money we don't have. If you're a smart drunk like me, you're trying to put the make on some dolly down there at the end of the bar and impress the heck out of them, you know? And you know what? In this group of six guys I went to meet, fact of life, there wasn't one common laborer in the whole bunch. We were all brain surgeons and jet pilots and astronauts and doctors and lawyers and devout liars. And in this group of six guys was a new guy. His name was Pete. And Pete was one of those intellectual giants you meet in bars. You bar drinkers again know what I'm talking about. That's that guy or gal who sits down there at the end of the bar and has the answer to every living subject in the world. And they drive people like you and I nuts, you know? And that was Pete. I mean, if you had marital problems and I had marital problems, he had the answers. If you had legal problems, he had the answers. If you had medical problems, he had the answers. If you had engineering problems, he had the answers. I thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know? I thought, how can one guy know so much about so many things? And he continued that drunk with us, and thank God he did, because as it turned out, Pete was really quite the guy. He was the one guy in the group who it seemed could find a jug on election day in a dry state. You know, one of them great guys. And besides that, he had A-negative blood, and I stuck pretty close to him. Just lost half the room again here, you know that? You know I know that? No matter where I go in this country or any other country, by the time I hit the parking lot out here, three people at least are going to tap me on the shoulder, ask me the same damn question the world over. They all say, "Hey, man, what do you mean by that A-negative blood crap?" And just so we don't plug up the parking lot here tonight, I'll tell you ahead of time. First of all, if you have A-negative blood, it's rare blood. And when you're selling it to buy wine, you get more for A-negative than any other kind of blood. So I stuck close to Pete, you know. I mean, I might have been born at night, but not last night. And I can't tell you the series of events that happened. We were living in these abandoned cars, one of which was mine. You laugh. You know how your car gets to be an abandoned car? That's kind of a work of art. Yeah, the tires are usually flat, the battery's dead, it's out of gas, and it's usually 6 months behind in payments. Then legally it becomes an abandoned car. It also got to be our living room, our kitchen, our bedroom, and our bathroom. Got a little salty in there. And I can't tell you, but one of those mornings we all came to, and Pete didn't. And he had swallowed his tongue that night in a convulsion. And he was deader than a doornail. And I got fighting mad at everything and everybody. And God, if there is a God, because my great intellect and better judgment took over again, which incidentally got you here and got me here. Our great intellect and better judgment takes over. And said to myself, "Self, if there's a God, why would he let a good guy like Pete go, who knows everything there is to know about everything, and let me stay?" And then I can't tell you the serious event that happened after Pete was gone. But this is what I never want to forget as long as I live. Early morning on the 13th of January, 1964, some phenomena started taking place. I don't even know what the hell a phenomena is. But some weird stuff started happening. Because all of a sudden, out of that radio, came the most beautiful music I ever heard in my life. I know today it was hallucinations because the battery's dead, right? But it's as real as I'm standing here. It was like the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra was in the car with us, and the thought came to me, man, this is how it must be just before you check out. And whether you believe this or not, everybody sitting here tonight all have a little tape up here that you conjured up and that I conjured up about your concept of what it's going to be like when we check out and when I check out. And all of them are different. And mine had something to do with music being played. And then here was the music. And then I got scared. Have you ever been real scared? I mean, really, really scared? I thought cops aren't supposed to get scared. But I got real scared. And for the first time in my adult life, I got down on my knees in that sewer, cried out to a God I was absolutely certain did not exist. And if he did exist, he didn't want anything to do with a drunk like me. But I cried out the only prayer I knew. I said, God, if there be a God, the only prayer I know is help me. And through a series of unexplained happenings, which I believe are miracles, I got directed to one of them AA clubhouses. And I'm not here to promote them either. Because some of them I've seen in this country and other countries are dens of iniquity. But the one I went to was not, is not, will not be, as long as I got anything to do with it. And I walked in that clubhouse that day, and there were no meetings going on. Just two old goats sitting over there in the corner playing cribbage. And I walk in the door like that, and they're sitting over there, and they stopped playing cribbage. And one of them poked the other one and pointed at me, and he says, we better do something with that one. Or he's going to start jackknifing around the room here, you know. I mean, I wasn't nervous, just quick, you know. And they applied the only therapy they knew at that time. Did you hear that? The only therapy those two guys knew at that time. They gave me a bucket of paint and a paintbrush, figuring that I could paint faster than anybody else in the place. And I painted that damn clubhouse, and I can't tell you to this day how long it took. I don't know if it was 5 days, 50 days. I don't think it means a hell of a lot. But I'll never forget the day I finished. It was a bright Saturday morning like today, almost like today. It was wet half the day here. There were periods of sunshine here today. But I don't know what you call it. But I found out that one of that guy that was playing cribbage had been a painter all his life. And the old thinking came back that fast. Why me, God? Why wasn't he up there painting? And I'll fix their clocks. I'll get drunk at every one of these phonies. And I headed out the back door of that clubhouse, bound and determined to quit Alcoholics Anonymous, get drunk at every damn one of you. And then God, as I understand, God had to perform another miracle, and he had to do it damn fast because I was gone. And you know what? He moved a guy from Riverside, California to Glendale, California that second. Because I reached for that push bar in the back door of that clubhouse. It was on the second story. And I reached for that push bar, and the door opened up ahead of me. And there's this guy standing on a landing out there. He had a smile from ear to ear, and he says, hi! And I said, shove it! He says, why are you saying that to me? I don't even know you. I said, shove it anyhow. He said, come here, I want to talk to you. Brought me back in the meeting hall and set me down in these Henroy chairs, you know, them cold metal ones. All right, told him, a little slow on the trigger over there. I started to tell him about that gray-haired goats that he made me paint this club, and I'm going to get drunk at every one of them. Ended up being my sponsor. He said, if I'm going to be your sponsor, three things are going to happen to you, man. One, you're going to go to meetings. Two, you're going to study that book. And three, for the first time in your adult life, you're going to follow instructions. I thought, how the hell does he know that? And at that time in the Los Angeles, in the greater Los Angeles area, there were 700 meetings a week in the greater Los Angeles area. And we made them all. Today there's 2,400 a week. And I still make a lot of them. But we started going to meetings all the time. Well, I mean, it was meetings every night. And newcomers, it's going to happen to you because it's happened to every one of us. So don't feel bad about it. You're going to say to your wife, your husband, your buddy, your girlfriend, meetings every night. Tonight I'm not going. And that night he came by early. Put me in the car and started down the freeway. I said, where are we going tonight? And he's a crusty old bugger, and he says, we're going to the hole in the ground. I thought, oh, my God, now they're going to bury me. And I'm sure none of you know where the hole in the ground is, but it was started by a guy by the name of Tex Adams, who'd been sober since Lincoln had the measles. And And he told me I had to study this book. He would not let up. I mean, he'd get me in a corner with this book, stand in the corner, and he'd start pounding on the book, and he'd start saying things to me like, between page 1 and 164 of this book is how drunks like him and millions of others before him had found a way of not to die from chronic alcoholism. He said, and if you don't want to do it, then get the hell away from me. I thought, how can he talk to a sick alcoholic like that? Don't you understand? We're sensitive. He literally saved my life. He motivated me to do the one thing I would never have done on my own volition. I cracked the book, the cover of the book, and I found me in there. And we got to the Huntington Park that night and started down the steps into the E-Bell Club. And I can't explain this. Another one of those unexplained happenings. This feeling came all the way from the toes, I think. And I know today what it was. It's the first honest feeling I had in sobriety. Because up until that minute, I'm a phony, a cheat, a liar, and a con. If you don't know what a con is, you're looking at one. But I did spot a couple more in here tonight. I'm glad all you con artists are here. And I asked him, I said, Joe, I got to ask you something. He turned around real gruff, and he's like he was. And he says, yeah, what do you want now? And I knew that second that he'd had me up to here. He was sick and tired of my BS, and I knew it. And I asked him that world-famous question that all newcomers are compelled to ask their sponsor. How long do I have to go to these damn meetings? And this wise old man with the X-ray vision got fight mad that fast, took his index finger and shoved me into the corner outside the meeting hall so they wouldn't hear it inside. When he got me in the corner where I couldn't get away, he started to get violent. Yeah. He started to take his index finger and started to hit me in the chest like this. And he started to scream. He said, you idiot! I didn't like that. He said, you have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings. Then you don't have to go to meetings anymore. Didn't make much sense then, but it sure does now. But that night, because he hit me in the chest and screamed at me, I'll fix his clock. I might have to be in a meeting, but I'm not going to listen. Bunch of you doing it tonight, too. But them old-timers are smart, you know. They set you here in the front row so you don't nod off, right, Barbara? And then they said something from the podium I didn't like. They said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. I turned around, looked this herd over, and I thought, by God, I wouldn't have drank with half of these people. I mean, there's a couple here tonight I wouldn't drink with right now. Right, Bob? And I just made up my mind, I'm not going to listen to a damn thing you got to say. And I had to do something to pass the time. I'm trapped. He's got the keys. I know he won't give them to me. So I had to start staring around the room counting light bulbs. I'd have had a blast in here. And then I ran out of light bulbs. And then I started winking at girls. And then I run out of girls. Then I spot this guy about halfway back. He's scribbling on a piece of paper. I didn't know you had to take notes here. So I watch him. And all of a sudden, he gets out of the road he's sitting in, gets up, walks over there, goes to the door, takes this piece of paper he's scribbling on, takes a thumbtack, sticks it on the bulletin board, and split. I didn't know you could do that. And I'm an ex-cop, and I'm nosy by nature. And I got to find out what's on that piece of paper, right? Big deal. And I sneak over to the bulletin board, get that piece of paper off the bulletin board that he'd been writing on. Don't tell me there's no miracles. You know what was on that piece of paper? It was a little poem about drunks. And I read it, and it made sense. And when nobody was looking, I stole it. We got to talk about one other thing and then get out of here. Because nobody wants to talk about it anymore. I don't know why not. It's about alcoholism, the family disease. Alcoholism is family disease. If you don't believe me, next week, whenever, go visit your neighborhood junior high school at high noon. Go in the lunchroom, stand back against the wall. Watch the effects of alcoholism right before your eyes. You know what's going on there? You all know what's going on there. You all been there. Those kids are all sitting down at these long tables like this. And they're all having a bowl of soup and a sandwich and a cup of milk, and they're all doing the same identical thing. They're all talking. The girls are talking about the things they did with their mother last night. The boys are talking about the things they did with their father last night. And they're all talking about the things they did this summer as a family and what they're going to do this Christmas as a family and all that kind of stuff. Well, I'll tell you what, no matter what junior high school you decide to go, in any place in this world, the same thing's happening. There's a kid sitting over here and one over there and one down there, and they got their head down in the soup and they ain't saying nothing to nobody. Because you know what happened at their house last night? Like happened at my house and your house. About 3 a.m, their drunken mother or their drunken father got them all out of sound sleep. And the screaming and the hollering and all the profanity that goes on in alcoholic houses started all over again. Calling their mother a damn whore and all that crap. And you want to know something? They never forget that. They might forgive you someday, but they never forget that. And just so you know, I didn't get here by mistake. One of those times out of hundreds, I got them all out of a sound sleep and screaming and hollering and all the profanity. Start all over again. And the youngest was a boy, 13 at the time. Had his mother in the kitchen. I'm shoving her around again. And he reached in the kitchen drawer and pulled out a butcher knife. Looked me right in the eye and said, "You lay one more hand on my mother and I'll run it through you." And for the first time in my adult life, I backed away from a punk-nosed 13-year-old kid. Not because he had a butcher knife, but because I could see the hate in his eyes. The hate that I had put there and booze had put there. And today, that same kid is 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he loves his dad. And he misses his mom. And that's what happens in alcoholic houses. And so I'm eternally grateful for my time here and the people I've had the opportunity to meet over the years. Because I believe this is an earned privilege. It is not given. You earn the right to do this and suit up and show up and do what's asked of you in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope and pray before they throw dirt in my face, I'll get to meet them all. Because I'll tell you another fact of life. They say there's about 2 million sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous in our country today. And I consider it a real privilege because I believe I had the privilege to eyeball 50% of them, eyeball to eyeball. And I believe that's an earned privilege, like I say. And I'll tell you another fact of life that is unusual to be said in a room like this, coming from where we've all come from and what we've all done in our life. Some of the finest people I've ever met in my life all turn out to be sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're the blessed ones. We're the lucky ones. We're the ones that have made it. We think about all those out there that are still suffering tonight, dying on the streets of chronic alcoholism. And so I consider it just a big privilege to sit amongst you and be counted amongst you as another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, no more, no less. That's as high as we get in this outfit, sober. As high as we get in this outfit, sober. And I'm eternally grateful for those times. I guess it's important I tell you, it's about time to go. Tell you what was on that piece of paper. There's that little poem about drunks. There's a little poem entitled, "Which Place?" I dreamed one night I passed away, left this world behind. Started down that lonesome trail some of my friends to find. Came to a signboard on the trail, directions it did tell. keep right to go to heaven, turn left to go to hell. I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless, boozing rake. I knew that at the crossroads, the path I'd have to take. So I started on the rocky path that leads to Satan's place, and shook within, not knowing just what I'd have to face. Old Satan met me at the gate, "What's your name, my friend?" I said, "I'm just old sober Sam that's come to a sad end." He glanced through some files. "You made a mistake, I fear. You're listed as an alcoholic. We don't want you here." I said, "I'm looking for my friends." And a smile stole over his face. "If your friends are alcoholics, they're in the other place." So I went back the other way till the crossroads I had seen and turned right to heaven, as happy as could be. St. Peter smiled and said, "Come in. For you, I have a berth. You're an alcoholic. You've been through hell on earth." I saw old Dub and old Pete too, Bill C. and a friend called Bell. And brother, I was tickled because I thought they'd gone to hell. So brothers, all take warning. Learn something from my trip. You've got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tempts you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell him you're going to heaven and he can go to hell. Thank you.